Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're talking about one of the most famous combat formations in history, the Shield Wall.
The Shield Wall. Even the word itself sounds monumental, doesn't it? You immediately picture those images. Warriors standing shoulder to shoulder, shields overlapping, a living wall of wood and metal.
And that's essentially what it was. One of the most effective defensive formations used by Vikings and Normans during the early and high Middle Ages. The Old Norse term was skjaldborg, by the way.
Skjaldborg, exactly. And if you picture it, the warriors really stood close together, practically shoulder to shoulder. And the shields, those typical round shields like the ones from the Gokstad find, were held so that the right side of each shield overlapped the left side of the neighbors.
That makes perfect sense for right-handers. You essentially get a double layer at the overlap points. I've experienced this myself in reenactment, and it's amazing how stable it feels when the formation is set.
And the shields themselves weren't small things. Archaeological finds show diameters of 80 to 100 centimeters, mostly made from linden wood.
Linden wood was ideal. Light enough to hold the shield for hours, yet it absorbs blows well. Probably 3 to 4 kilos per shield. That doesn't sound like much at first, but after half an hour in the wall, you feel every single gram.
And yet, these formations sometimes held for hours. The most famous example is probably...
You mean Hastings?
Yes, the Battle of Hastings in 1066. The Anglo-Saxons under Harold Godwinson had set up their shield wall on Senlac Hill, an elevated position wisely chosen. The Normans under William came with cavalry, archers, infantry, and initially couldn't break through the wall.
Many arrows were deflected by the shield wall, but there were still hits through gaps and unprotected areas. The historical sources aren't entirely clear on this. The cavalry lost momentum on the uphill charge. The formation held for hours. This demonstrates how effective this tactic was when properly employed.
But, and this is where it gets interesting, there were also clear weaknesses. And this is where modern experiments come into play.
These are truly illuminating. Researchers and reenactment groups have tried to recreate the shield wall in practice to understand what worked and what didn't.
And they found that a thin wall, meaning just one...
Just one row deep?
One row, exactly. That it probably wouldn't have held long on the battlefield. Only with two or more rows did the formation become truly stable.
That makes sense. The rear row provides support, can thrust spears through gaps, and when someone falls in front, replacement moves up immediately.
And what ultimately led to collapse? Exhaustion was central, but often it was a combination of fatigue, flanking threats, casualties, and psychological pressure. The warriors simply reached the end of their strength at some point.
That's a detail you only truly understand when you've tried it yourself. In reenactment, after 10 minutes of intense shield combat, you feel your arms burning. Now imagine that for hours, in full gear, with real adrenaline.
And this physical experience is the key to truly understanding the tactics. The shield wall was much more than just standing side by side and hoping for the best.
It was tactics, discipline, and yes, a good deal of psychology too. And we'll talk about that in a moment. What makes these experiments so fascinating is the question of why. Sure, a thin shield wall doesn't hold, But why exactly does depth make such a difference?
This is where it gets technical.
When you only have one row, you bear the entire weight of the battle alone. Every blow against your shield, every thrust, it goes directly into your arms, your shoulders. But with a second row behind you, something crucial happens. They push against you from behind.
So not just moral support, but literally physical pressure.
Physical pressure that stabilizes you. You're not pushed back as easily. And the rear row can thrust spears over the shoulders of those in front. You suddenly have more weapons pointing forward without the formation losing its density.
Plus, when someone in front falls or is exhausted, someone immediately moves up. The wall essentially regenerates itself.
And here's a detail that's often overlooked. The shield boss. That hemispherical metal dome in the center of the shield.
Made of iron, bronze is more associated with the migration period, so centuries earlier. It not only protects the hand behind it, but structurally reinforces the entire shield. When blows hit the center, the boss distributes the impact.
And in the shield wall, it's what allows the shields to truly overlap closely. In reenactment, there's often the idea that the bosses sort of interlock. Whether that was historically accurate, we don't know for certain, but it makes the line more stable than loosely arranged boards.
In reenactment, you notice it immediately. With a shield without a proper boss, the formation feels wobbly.
Unstable. The boss is the heart of it. But, and this is the real insight from the experiments, even with perfect equipment and optimal depth, there was still one factor that dominated everything.
Exhaustion.
Exhaustion. And this isn't trivial. In the tests, they measured how long formations could maintain their structure. The thin wall collapsed after minutes. The deeper one held significantly longer, but it too eventually collapsed.
Not because the tactics failed, but because the people were finished.
That's the crucial point. Imagine, you're holding a shield weighing 3-4 kilos, with your arm bent close to your body hour after hour. Add the armor, the helmet, the tension. The experiments showed that it wasn't the enemy attack that broke shield walls. It was the body giving up.
This also explains why historical sources often mention pauses. Both sides would withdraw, catch their breath, and then continue. This wasn't courtesy, it was physical necessity.
And then there's the problem with the...
You're talking about flanking!
The deeper the formation, the more men stand in the center. But the flanks, the ends of the wall, don't automatically become stronger. On the contrary, if the enemy attacks from the side, they can bypass all that depth.
That's why terrain selection was so critical. Commanders sought positions where natural obstacles protected the flanks. A swamp on one side, a steep slope on the other.
In reenactment, we sometimes simulate this with marked zones. And even there, you notice how vulnerable these points are. A breakthrough on the flank, and the entire formation falls apart.
So it was always a trade-off. More depth for stability, but greater danger on the sides. The perfect shield wall didn't exist. Only the best possible one for each situation.
And that's what I find truly enlightening about these experiments. They make clear that this wasn't a wonder weapon. The shield wall worked because people kept it alive, through discipline, endurance, and smart planning.
The best formation is useless if you're deployed in the wrong place. Commanders knew this. Terrain selection could be decisive, sometimes more important than you'd think, but still just one factor alongside troop strength, quality, and leadership.
That sounds logical. But how exactly did it work? You couldn't always choose where to fight.
Not always, but often enough. Experienced commanders deliberately sought positions that minimized their weaknesses. A hill, for example. It offers several advantages.
Better visibility, obviously. You can see what the enemy is doing, where they're gathering.
And you force them to attack uphill. That sounds minor, but imagine. You're carrying weapons, a shield, maybe chainmail. Now you're also running uphill against a line of shields pressing down on you. That's exhausting before the actual fight even begins.
At Hastings, that was exactly the situation. The Anglo-Saxons on the hill, the Normans had to charge upward.
And they spent hours trying to break through that shield wall. The slope slowed down the Norman cavalry, the horses lost momentum. Without that elevated position, the battle would probably have turned out quite differently.
What about the flanks? A hill doesn't automatically protect the sides.
That's why smart commanders look for natural barriers. A swamp on one side, a river on the other, and suddenly the enemy can only attack you head-on.
That massively reduces the attack surface. You need fewer men to hold the formation, because you know where the pressure is coming from.
That's essentially classic resource management. You use the terrain as an extra defender that never gets tired.
But what if you had to attack yourself? The shield wall is primarily defensive.
For that, the Vikings developed something special. The
boar snout.
The boar snout, yes. Svinfylking in Old Norse, literally the swine array. The name alone is quite a statement.
Because the boar represented ferocity and fighting spirit?
And penetrating power. The formation was a wedge, triangular, with the point facing forward. At the tip stood the most experienced, best armored warriors. Their job was to break through the enemy shield wall at a single point.
And behind them, the formation widened, row by row. Like an arrow boring into flesh and then spreading apart.
That's a fitting image. According to modern reconstructions, the flanks were probably lined with spearmen. They could have countered cavalry attacks. And interestingly, family members and clansmen likely stood next to each other. At least, that's what later sources suggest.
That strengthens cohesion. You're not just fighting for yourself, but for your brother beside you.
And you're less likely to flee when your father stands behind you. The social bond was part of the tactics.
Was the formation effective? Or more theory than practice?
In demonstrations and, well, in modern reenactment, the wedge has proven to work. The pressure concentrates on a single point, and if that gives way, the line is broken.
But there was a catch, wasn't there? Such an aggressive formation must have weaknesses.
Two major weaknesses, yes. First, the flanks. Because the formation is oriented forward, the sides are, I'd say, vulnerable, almost exposed. If the opponent doesn't break and instead outflanks you, it becomes critical.
And second?
The shock factor. The boar snout was designed for an immediate breakthrough. If it didn't punch through quickly, it lacked the staying power for a prolonged fight. The formation was an all-or-nothing maneuver.
That explains why not every battle began with a wedge attack. The risk was enormous.
Interestingly, the invention of the Svinfylking was attributed to the god Odin in the sagas. That shows how highly regarded this tactic was. Of divine origin, essentially.
A divine tool for breaking through. That fits the Viking mentality. When we talk about shields, most people think of protection first. But that's only part of the story. In the early Middle Ages, a shield was so much more. It was a statement.
You mean the painting?
The painting, the shape, the symbols. Shields could express status and belonging. Whether they were regularly present at feasts and gatherings isn't well documented, but they were definitely part of one's identity, a sign of clan and status.
Like a coat of arms, only earlier.
Earlier and more personal, I'd say. The motifs on Viking shields weren't standardized like later heraldry. We like to imagine dragons, wolves, ravens. We know those from the sagas. Archaeologically, though, simpler geometric patterns are what we can actually verify.
In the sagas, the dragon was particularly popular. And on ships, we see this in reality too. Think of the dragon heads on longships. They were meant to intimidate the enemy before a single sword was drawn.
And then the colors. The famous Gokstad shields, around 900 AD, were yellow and black, so actually not red. This is one of the few concrete archaeological pieces of evidence we have for shield colors, by the way. But the effect was clear. This was psychological warfare.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Imagine standing opposite a shield wall. Dozens of shields, all painted with dragons, serpents, runes. The colors are vivid. The warriors beat their weapons against them. It's designed to instill fear.
And at the same time, it strengthens your own cohesion. When you stand next to someone whose shield bears the same symbols as yours, that creates a bond. You're not fighting alone. You're fighting for something greater.
Runes were also used, right?
Runes, yes. They weren't just writing. They had magical significance. Certain runes were believed to offer protection, strength and courage. Whether they were actually placed on shields is hardly documented. But the idea is almost like a prayer you carry with you.
And then there's what's now called the Falknut, three interlocking triangles. We know it from Gotlandic picture stones like Stora Hammars and from the Osebek ship, where it appears as a wood carving, dated around 834. Whether it was used on shields isn't documented, but in reenactment it's often associated with Odin, essentially under the protection of the All-Father.
The round shields of the Vikings were ideal for this, because the large surface offered plenty of room for...
So, lots of space for design!
For design, absolutely. 80 to 100 centimeters in diameter, that's a canvas. But this shape also had practical reasons. The round shield protects equally well in all directions, perfect for foot combat.
And then came the shift. In the 11th century, we see more and more shields taking a teardrop shape, the so-called Norman shields.
Those are familiar from the Bayeux Tapestry.
Right. And when you look at the shape, you immediately understand why. The Norman shield is elongated, narrow, tapering to a point at the bottom. It no longer protects all around, it specifically protects from top to bottom.
Because the Normans increasingly fought from horseback.
Mounted combat became more important. And when you're in the saddle, you need protection for your upper body and, crucially, for your legs. They hang down on the horse, unprotected. The teardrop-shaped shield covers exactly this area.
So the shield shape follows the fighting style. That's logical when you think about it, but also remarkable.
The Vikings primarily fought on foot in formations like the shield wall. The round shield was perfect for that. The Normans relied on cavalry and needed a different shield for it.
This illustrates that weapons and equipment weren't static things. They evolved with the tactics, with the way people fought. The shield tells the story of its bearer.
And of its time. A round shield with a dragon motif tells you, here's someone fighting on foot, in close formation, wanting to intimidate their enemy. A Norman shield says, here comes a rider, fast and mobile.
The shape and design really reveal the mindset of the fighters. The shield was never just a defensive weapon. It was communication.
communication with the enemy, with your own people, even with the gods. Every symbol, every color had meaning. What I appreciate about this topic, the shield wall illustrates that history isn't just dates and names. It's about people who had to make decisions.
And these experiments make it all tangible. When you feel that pressure yourself, the sheer effort of holding the formation, you suddenly understand what these warriors went through physically.
That's the value of such reconstructions. You can read 100 books about exhaustion and battle, but when you experience it firsthand, abstract knowledge becomes real understanding.
And that applies not just to the shield wall. The question of why shields looked the way they did, why certain tactics worked and others didn't, all of this opens a window into the mindset of medieval soldiers.
People who made the best of their situation with the means of their time, using the materials that were available, developing formations that suited their weapons.
The shield is almost like a common thread through history. From the early Vikings with their painted round shields to the knights of the High Middle Ages, it was always there.
It changed, adapted, from round shield to kite shield, from foot combat to mounted combat. But the basic function remained, to offer protection, and at the same time...
It was about showing identity.
Showing identity. The shield was never just a piece of wood with metal fittings. It was an expression of who you were and what you fought for.
That's what I find fascinating about topics like this. You start with a question. How did a shield wall actually work? And end up with questions about culture, psychology, human endurance.
And there's still so much more to discover. Vikings, Normans, knights. Every era has its own stories, its own tactics, its own equipment.
If you're now eager to dive deeper, the Battle Merchant blog has plenty more articles on historical topics. From weapons to armor to everyday objects, there's something for every history enthusiast.
And of course, the right equipment if you want to stand in a shield wall yourself someday. But that's another story.
For today, we say thanks for listening.
Until next time, when we dive into history together again. Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.